There's some cool new theme music from our new sponsor, Lens Distortions. More on that in a minute. But first, hello, and welcome to the Art of the Cut podcast, brought to you in partnership with Boris Effects and our sponsors, Jump Desktop and now Lens Distortions. I'm Steve Hallfish. I'm a working film and TV editor, and for the last 9 years, I've done more than 400 interviews with the world's best editors. I've been using Boris Effects products for nearly 30 years, and I'm proud to partner with them to bring you some great filmmaking content. Today, we're talking with Eddie Hamilton, ACE, about Mission Impossible: Dead Reckoning. Eddie was last on Art of the Cut to discuss Top Gun Maverick, which was the most listened to episode of the last year. He also talked with Art of the Cut about Mission Impossible Fallout, Kingsman: The Golden Circle, Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, and Kingsman: Secret Service. I think that's enough enormous blockbusters, but I'll also throw in Kick-Ass, Kick-Ass 2, X-Men First Class, and even Resident Evil Apocalypse almost 2 decades ago. Before I hop into our discussion with Eddie, a brief thank you to our sponsors. Jump Desktop is a high-performance and secure app that lets you virtually connect to your editing bay as if you were physically there. Keep all your assets in one place and connect to your powerful editing bays from anywhere. Jump Desktop's high-performance remote desktop protocol lets you edit from any low-powered laptop. With end-to-end encryption, native support for macOS and Windows, and multi-monitor support, you can be productive from anywhere. Jump Desktop also has collaborative screen sharing for collaboration with your team. See what thousands of editors have been using to get their work done from across the world. Visit jumpdesktop.com/cut to begin your free, no-limits 14-day trial today. And to our partner, Boris Effects. I've been using Boris Effects and Sapphire for almost 30 years, so they're not just a sponsor to me. I feel like they've been a partner in my cutting room for decades, helping me to deliver on the creative vision of my clients, directors, and producers. For all of us, our work is about bringing a creative idea to the screen, and for me, Boris Effects is one of the important tools that I use to do that. To see how they can help you on your latest project, head on over to borisfx.com and check out the Boris Effects suite, which includes Sapphire, Continuum, Mocha Pro, Silhouette, and Optics, all in a low-cost monthly or annual subscription. If you want to read this interview with great visual support, you can go to borisfx.com/AOTC. That site also has other great filmmaking content, so keep that bookmarked. We're almost ready for this week's interview, but first, let me tell you about our latest sponsor, Lens Distortions. Lens Distortions offers premium music and effects that are perfect for editors like us. With a completely instrumental music catalog, highly curated sound effects, and tasteful visual assets, you're sure to find something to elevate your next edit. I've been using Lens Distortions assets for years, and their quality is second to none. They have a special offer just for Art of the Cut listeners. Visit lensdistortions.com/AOTC to claim your discount. That's lensdistortions.com/AOTC. I enjoyed this movie so much. I went with my family and it just flew by. I honestly felt like it was an hour long. The pacing was fantastic.
That's so kind of you to say. We work at it and work at it and work at it to make sure that that's the end result. We're very sensitive to audiences telling us when things are too long. So we really compress it as much as we possibly can to get the pace as smooth as possible.
It definitely shows. One of the things that you talk about process, you said you work at it and work at it and work at it, right? This is not a one and done thing. You maybe had it too long at some point. What was the editor's cut? What was the length?
Yeah, I think it's very important to, as you say, trust the process. Something which I've heard you say a lot, actually, Steve. And it's important for everyone involved in the process to understand that everything starts out too long and boring and baggy and unfocused and a bit of a mess, quite frankly. And it takes a lot of work to get stuff really effortless to watch and enjoy. I think we started out with a cut that was over 4 hours. So 4 hours, 20, maybe something like that. Anything that they shot where I was like, there's something in there. I don't know if it'll be useful. Stick it in the timeline. And of course, I was keeping Chris McQuarrie updated as we were going through, saying, look, the movie's like 2.5 now. Now it's 3.5. Now it's 4. And of course, the producers don't want to hear that. But guys, it's going to be fine. We're going to get it down. We got some deleted scenes, but not a whole lot. A lot of it was just fat and compression and ideas that they were trying out on location. And then in the fullness of time, we look at the movie and we thought that was essential. And now it's not, the usual stuff. But you have to remember, this movie was quite an undertaking because we started in September 2020. We finished Top Gun at the end of July 2020. Then I had a month off. Then we started at the beginning of September 2020. And now, look, we're at July 2023. And we finished the movie 2 weeks ago. So it was well over 2.5 years of work. I mean, nearly 3 years of work in total. And I was working on the edit every day. I had a week off at Christmas both years. And that was it, really. So we've been working flat out. My whole team has been working flat out. The other thing to say, though, is that we have also been filming parts of part two of these two movies. We filmed about 40% of part two. So last year, for example, I spent about 5 months in total in South Africa, where Tom and Chris McCrory were filming the climactic aerial sequence for part two. And you would have seen a very short clip of Tom Cruise standing on a biplane introducing the screening of Top Gun Maverick that we did at CinemaCon in Las Vegas last year. No, that probably was April, maybe. Anyway, we were out there in South Africa and we filmed, and he wanted to do a very dynamic introduction. You can look at it on YouTube. It's a clip where he's standing on a biplane and then these biplanes dive away at the end, and it's stomach churning when you watch it. And that was filmed on the way home from one of our shoot days. And this sequence, I mean, there's more stunts in this than almost the entire rest of the movies put together. Not exaggerating. Tom was risking his life every day for months. Astonishingly dangerous and dynamic and physical and real. When we were shooting that, for example, the edit of part one was sort of on the back burner as I was assembling all this footage from part two. And we filmed other pieces of part two, which we had to do because of cast availability. So we probably worked for maybe 7 or 8 months in total on part two, out of this nearly 3 year process of part one. What we would do is, I took a week before Christmas in Christmas 21. I took a week and I went to New York and worked with Chris McCrory. And then in January 22, I took 2 weeks and went to Florida and worked with Chris. And then in the summer of 22, we took about 6 weeks and we went to Maine, where Chris has quite a few friends. And so we rented a house. We set up my laptop in there with my big 160 terabyte hard drive. We chipped away at it. And Christmas, we worked on the airport sequence. And then in January, we worked mostly on the train sequence. And then in the summer, we worked mostly on the desert and Rome and the sequence in the Department of National Intelligence, which is that big long dialogue scene where the guy walks in with the suspicious briefcase. And then earlier this year, we went and shot on an aircraft carrier. We went to the Oscars in March, and then we went to the Arctic. We went to Svalbard, which is this tiny island. It's the northernmost inhabited part of planet Earth, apart from the North Pole. We were filming out there in the Arctic. We called it March Madness because we were going all over the world and doing so much. Then at the end of March, so then we had April, May, June to dive in and do our test screenings. Our first friends and family screening, which is pretty hairy, that was in October 22. And that was the first time anyone on the planet had ever watched the movie from beginning to end. Chris and I have been working on pieces of it. And what Chris likes to do, which I shudder in horror at, is he invites 50 friends to come and watch the movie. Some of them filmmakers, you know, Edgar Wright came, Joe Cornish came, for example, quite a few screenwriters that Chris knows. And we screened the movie. And at that point, it was nearly 4 hours long. So, you know, an hour and 20 minutes longer than it ended up in the final cut. There's no music, okay? So it's totally dry and there's barely any sound effects because Chris, he likes the sound to be really good or to have no sound because he thinks it's distracting if the sound is average, which I kind of agree with. So large chunks of the movie, like the running around Venice and stuff and the fighting, was totally silent and much, much, much longer. They shot so much of the running around Venice alleyways. I mean, it went on forever, you know. If you've ever sat down and watched a film with just dialogue, no sound effects, and a lot of it totally mute, it is quite a spiritual experience. in some ways, because it's very pure. It's just visual and emotion from the dialogue, and you're not being steered at all. But it's what Chris likes to do. Chris warned everybody, no finished visual effect shots, very long, no music, you know, won't be offended if you fall asleep. So then what we did is we stopped after 2.5 hours, which was the end of Venice. And then everyone had a bathroom break and a drink. And then we all came back in, and then we watched like another hour and a half, which was the train sequence, for better or for worse, in whatever condition stuff was in, you know, loads of green screens and, you know, all that. But the good news was, at that point, there wasn't really much confusion, or at least everyone who was there was like, yeah, we can see where this is going, and you've clearly got a lot of work to do, but you will get there. And then we learned a lot. We did 3 full Cold Recruit audience previews. Tom and McHugh lean into that process. They really embrace it. We did get some stuff where people were really confused about this or that. So I'll give you an example, which I haven't really talked about, but the biggest thing we discovered from our first preview, and you as a filmmaker and everyone listening to this will understand, at the end of Venice, after the scene where Grace is offered the choice to join the team, and she says, can I think about it? And Benji goes, the train leaves in 3 hours. Then there was the scene between Ethan and Luther. And at the end of that scene, they both got darted. And then the camera swung around and you saw, we called her the Grey Widow, which was Grace in the widow mask. Spoilers. And you realize that she was basically going to go on the train in the mask on her own and try and figure out her own destiny and not have the team. The audience flat out rejected that because they said Grace outwits Ethan one time too many in the film. If you think about it, she walks away in the airport. She leaves him at the end of Rome because she handcuffs him to the car. And then Ethan is foolish enough to trust her at the end of Venice. And then she does this thing on her own. And people just didn't really buy into that. They didn't like the fact that she outwitted the team. They didn't like the fact that Ethan looked stupid. They weren't really with her on the journey of the final act of the movie. So we listened to that and we were like, okay, we've gone too far here. So then we reshot that scene where the mask machine breaks, you know, where Ethan has to go in and the mask machine breaks and he says, you're going to have to go on your own. And Benji will figure out a way that I can jump on the train, of course. So that was one of the big discoveries from our test screening, which, again, I'm just leaning into your question about process. This is all answering that question. It was quite a challenge because McHugh and Tom and I, we go and spend a day or 2 days after each preview poring over all the feedback and really putting our heads together about how we can fix a problem like that, which is quite a challenge because, you know, it's only a day of pickups, but it's the whole cast, right? And Rebecca Ferguson is on June and Simon Pegg is on something else. And Ving Rhames is in LA. So it's quite a big undertaking to bring everybody back just for one day of filming. But full support of Paramount Pictures, you know, for the HODs, they all understood that this was a great solution to the problem, which the audience was, they were marking us down considerably for the third act of the movie. They were very positive about the first 2 acts. There was problems with the beginning, which we figured out. The middle was working very well. People just said it's a bit long. When people say something's a bit long, you just have to confront every shot and every emotional beat in that sequence and go, is it essential? And then you just have to take out anything that isn't. And what Tom said to us is you always have to leave the audience wanting more throughout the movie. That's so important because it's a rich meal. Any movie that's over 2 hours is a rich meal. If a movie's over 2.5 hours, it's a very rich meal. And so you want each course to not fill you up, quite frankly. You want to still have room left to, you know, enjoy the rest of the movie. And at the beginning, when you're working with a 4-hour movie, it feels very unwieldy and almost an overwhelming challenge, you know, a huge mountain to climb. Like, how are we ever going to figure out how to get this down? How is it ever going to flow effortlessly and be fun to watch? And, you know, after each preview, we slowly got the time down. And then on our third preview, people were still telling us that bits were too long. So we went into the Rome car chase, especially the bit where they're in the BMW. We cut out about half of that because people have seen Tom driving in a BMW before. They haven't seen him driving handcuffed to someone else with one hand, you know. And so let's get onto the Fiat because that's the really fun sequence. We were brutal. And McHugh and I are building a deleted shots reel just set to music, which we will put on the home entertainment special features. So you'll get to see all the stuff that we cut out. Some of it
is in trailers. If you watch some of the trailers, you'll go, wait, that wasn't in the movie. But that's because we have to be brutally honest with ourselves going through the film. You know this. Everyone listening should know this. If it can go, it must go. It's as simple as that. The art of editing is compressing the maximum amount of story in the shortest possible time, especially with modern audiences. And I certainly learned that. If you watch the original 1986 Top Gun and our 2022 Top Gun Maverick, the paces, the aerial sequences are much tighter in terms of editing. If you show people the original Top Gun now, it does feel kind of slow. Even though it's legendary, it's still a bit slow for today's audiences. And so we're in the process of collapsing time as much as possible so that the audience doesn't drift away. I think the first version we screened for an audience was like 257. Then we got it down to 252 and then 247 or something. And without credits, that was. And then now with the brutal last compression pass in the last 2 weeks of editing at the end of May this year, we got 236 without credits. Honestly, if you'd asked any of us when we were watching the 4-hour edit, if we would ever get it down to 236, we all would have scratched our heads and been very puzzled about how we would find our way there. But somehow when you trust the process and you listen to the audience very carefully, and we did like two or three other friends and family screenings, maybe four. So four friends and families, and three full previews. I always invite my close editing buddies to the last friends and family because I want them all to stab me in the front at that point. We've got 2 weeks to go of actual creative editing. We've been sound mixing the whole time, but basically the deadline is approaching and we've got 2 weeks left. So I invite all my editor buddies and I say, you guys, you've got to stab me in the front with all sincerity. I just need to know everywhere that you felt air in the movie and anywhere that felt bumpy or that you were knocked off the ride or that didn't feel effortless to watch. And believe it or not, even after our last friends and family screening, we actually built a set and reshot Ethan's introduction because what we had didn't work. Some version of that will be in the next movie. So I'm not going to tell you what it was, but we needed to radically simplify Ethan's introduction. And then McHugh had this great idea of using the gig economy, a food delivery guy coming in, which is so of the moment, you know, with DoorDash and Deliveroo and all those companies flourishing at the moment. And he came up with this idea of this delivery guy and Ethan stood in the shadows and this kind of mythical introduction with Ethan stepping out of the shadows. And then he says, you know, what is the oath? This whole IMF oath is something that we invented for this movie. But again, it feeds into our efforts to re-mythologize the Impossible Mission Force for a lot of people who would never have seen any of the other missions. You know, in our test screenings, over half of the audience had not seen any other missions before. So we knew there was an untapped audience out there. But because of the enormous goodwill from Top Gun Maverick, we knew that Tom's certainly right up there with the biggest stars in the world, if not the biggest star in the world. And there'll be a lot of people who saw Top Gun and were reintroduced to Tom or even introduced to Tom for maybe the first time, if they're a younger audience, who might be interested to check this film out on the big screen. So we wanted to re-mythologize the IMF and that idea of giving Ethan a very simple introduction. We used to have a much more ambitious mission briefing style, but we wanted to keep it super simple with just photographs, which is very analog and appropriate for this movie. And then, of course, the self-destruct happens inside the food delivery bag, which is quite fun. You know, if you watch the original show, part of the fun of it was always, how is Jim Phelps or Dan Briggs? How is he ever going to get the mission? He's going in a record shop or he's going to meet somebody on the roof of a building or he's going into a subway. So it was always kind of fun. So that introduction to Ethan was simplified down to a very short scene just to get us to the desert quicker, which is where the action with Ethan and Ilsa kicks off. That kind of answers your question about our process and getting the film down to where you found it, just a rocket ride, which was what Tom kept telling. He's like, it's got to feel like a rocket ride. Even though we take our time where we need to, you've just got to be leaning in the whole time and the music's got to be kind of pulling you through every transition. What McHugh said is, I'm daring you to go and take a pee in the film. It's like every time you think you've got to that point where you can like safely, you know, move out of the theater for 2 minutes to pee, he's like, no, you've got to keep watching. But luckily, from your reaction and from the audience's reaction so far, we seem to have succeeded, which is enormously gratifying.
Yeah. Speaking about that IMF mission thing at the beginning, if I remember correctly,
And it didn't bother me, it didn't bump me, but I noticed it. Doesn't the IMF playback of the recording start before he presses the play button?
Yeah, so that's something where in our effort to compress time, you know, if Ethan just walks over, takes the tape recorder out, presses, then you've wasted, and this is where we're talking like 7 or 8 seconds of screen time. And we don't have that time to waste in the first 20 minutes of the movie. It didn't bump you. You understood that he'd press play and we were cheating time and we were folding in the narrative a bit quicker. We're looking at every tiny micro beat of the story and going, can we compress this? Can we compress this? You know, you can fill it with a music cue, right? So we could have started a music cue as Ethan walked over and opened, you know, ripped open the envelope, took the tape recorder out, press play, listen. But then you've got to fill in the 7 or 8 seconds of voiceover that you've saved with other bits of business and images and stuff. And you feel it when you're watching the edit, you know, you feel like there's air here. I'm feeling like we want to move on. I think it was Tom's idea, actually. We initially started it a bit later. And then when we showed the scene to Tom, he was like, guys, you need to start the voiceover the moment I turn my head and the moment I walk out of the frame. And then the voiceover needs to start. Good evening, Mr. Hunt. The whole opening of the movie is, quite frankly, very long. This is the longest opening of any. I think it's even longer than any of the Bond movies.
Before the title sequence.
Before the title sequence. It's 28 minutes, which is a massively long time. Babylon was 32 minutes, but it was just the title of the movie saying Babylon. And of course, if you watch a movie like RRR from last year, you know, that kind of folds the title in over the first hour of the movie. So it's different. But for a kind of traditional Hollywood movie, it's very late. But it feels appropriate. Like you say, you don't even feel 28 minutes has gone by the time the opening titles comes up. It's just very satisfying that you see Ethan doing what he does at the end of that scene with Kittredge. And then he pulls the trigger and then we go into the light the fuse. We tried to pull the titles up earlier. We tried to put it after the submarine and after the mission briefing and after the desert and halfway through the desert and then before the... And every time it just felt flat. And so Tom said, it's got to be after a caper. Guys, it's 28 minutes in, but we have to try it. And literally, we'd never tried putting it there until 2 days before we locked picture.
Oh my gosh.
I know, literally, it was really late because we just felt to ourselves, we can't have the titles 28 minutes into the film. The other thing is not starting the movie on Ethan Hunt as well. We have this great opening prologue with this Russian submarine, which is, again, quite an ambitious, very dense sequence where we're trying to explain the real world effects of this AI and what it can cause right up front, even though you may not realize that that's what you're learning at the beginning of the movie. Hopefully, on reflection, you'll realize that the Russian submarine, what happens, you know, that I'm trying not to give spoilers, but, you know, what happens to the submarine is going to be magnified and is going to cause Ethan problems later in the movie. And then in the second movie, the stakes get dramatically bigger because we don't really explore the scale of what the entity can do in this movie. We're just sort of sowing the seeds of it and explaining that it's going to be doing something much bigger in the second film. Anyway, so there we are. That was the story of the opening of the movie and compressing even that 7 or 8 seconds and moving the mission brief up before he presses the tape recorder was a side effect of that editorial discovery.
You mentioned about how it's a very rich meal, and those 7 or 8 seconds are like the breadsticks. If you know you're going to have a rich meal, skip the breadsticks, right?
Yeah, you're right. You're right. You're absolutely right. And it's not a short film. You know, when I saw Super Mario Brothers early this year, I loved it because I've played their games with my kids for years. And I was sat with my daughter, and we both thought it was such fun. And I was delighted that it was 90 minutes long. Because when you're an editor on a movie like this, you spend day after day after day watching the entire movie through, especially towards the end when you're QCing everything. And of course, everything takes longer to mix and everything takes longer to score and everything takes longer to color correct. There's more visual effects, just all longer. And part of the reason for the length is the way that these films are made, which is a very organic, evolving process of discovery over the 2.5 years of production. But also because Chris and Tom wanted to make a real kind of epic story on a grand scale, which you can't really fit into 90 minutes. You know, if you look at Lawrence of Arabia or Bridge on the River Kwai or Ben-Hur, Gone with the Wind, you know, they're all massive epics, long sprawling adventures. Dances with Wolves is another of my favorite, Braveheart, you know, that kind of thing. And if you're in the mood for that, There's nothing quite like it. I love going to a cinema and getting lost in a movie for 3 hours. I love it. Love it. If you're in the mood, it's very satisfying. And when you're watching a movie where you're just in it the whole time, nothing beats that experience. It's just the magic of the movies, getting lost in a story, feeling everything with the protagonist and with the characters and wondering where it's going to go. And, you know, I think that's what they were attempting. And the next one is similarly as ambitious. It's going to be completely epic in scale, the next film. I mean, it really is. You will not be disappointed.
You know, one of the things that struck me, you were talking about how late the title sequence of the movie comes. I wonder if that helps make it feel shorter.
Yes, that was the other thing. So you're absolutely right. That's a very good point, Steve. So here's the notes we got from the audience in our previews. The movie only starts in the airport, which is quite frankly when Ethan meets Benji and Luther. And you feel like, because Mission Impossible is a team film. It's a team, like all the TV shows were team stories. And we have a protagonist who is Ethan Hunt, because Tom Cruise makes protagonist driven stories, which I feel are easier for the audience to engage with. And people were telling us, look, we like seeing the submarine. We love the submarine. We love seeing Ethan and Ilsa. And then there's the whole scene with the chit chat in the DNI and the dude walking in with the case. But the movie only starts when we get to the airport. And one way of fixing that is putting the opening titles just before the airport, because the movie in your mind, in the audience's mind, starts after the opening title sequence, you know. But yeah, you're right. So putting the opening titles there basically makes the film feel shorter, because there's considerably less of it after as well, you know. And then you get into the team, you meet Ethan and Benji, and then you're into the got to find this key and what it unlocks, and we've got to do this with the buyer, and you feel like you're in a mission-y kind of capery kind of thing at that point. Then you're on that journey, which is great.
You mentioned the DNI sequence, and there are some big close-ups in a conversation, and it's multiple people. So
yes.
I don't know how many people are in that scene, 6 or something, and that's
yes.
always so difficult to deal with.
Correct.
You got multiple eye lines, and I guess you really can't call it crossing the 180 because you've got multiple 180s, right? So can you talk about trying to juggle eye lines, where people are looking, how you know the geography?
That is a very good question indeed. And the same applies to the sequence in the nightclub when they're upstairs in the VIP area.
Exactly. Yep.
There's all these characters all chatting. So here's an interesting thing, which Chris McQuarrie was discussing with me when we started this. In his evolution as a visual storyteller is something that he's come across that appeals to him, which is he really is very precise with his lens choices when shooting any sequence, but especially dialogue. And he'll work out which lenses work best for an actor's face, 60 mil, 75. Usually it's a choice between 60 or 75 on this film. One of the theories which he is considering is that the longer the lens is, the more emotional the shot you get. Okay, so the wider the lens is, the more information you get. And the longer the lens is, the more emotion you get. And movies have to be and are an emotional experience. The audience is paying their money to buy an emotional experience. They're not buying information. And the emotion comes from people's faces, quite simply. So the closer you are to someone's face, the more intimate you are with that character at that moment. And the more you are feeling their emotions from how the performer is manipulating the muscles around their eyes and their face. And that's the fastest way to generate an emotional interaction with a character is be on a close-up. Music is the fastest way to generate an emotion from nothing. If you want the audience to feel something immediately, you can start playing music. But you can also have a similar effect by cutting to a big close-up of somebody in some kind of emotional state, and you will instantly start to feel that. And McHugh feels like wide shots in scenes are informational, not emotional. So you will notice there are very few wide shots in dialogue scenes in this movie. In the DNI, there's maybe 2. So there's a wide shot, high angle, when Cary Elwes walks around his desk and you get to reveal everybody in the room, because it's a high angle looking through the windows of his office. And then there is another wide shot, basically, where we introduce Henry Cerny as Kittredge. And he steps up and he walks over to the TV. He does his piece by the TV and then he walks back and we reveal a wide shot of the room for several seconds when he's doing his speech about none of our allies have willingly whispered one word of it to us, which means there's a global race on to acquire the two halves of this key. You know, that moment in the scene. So there's two wide shots in the VIP lounge in the nightclub. There is one wide shot at the beginning and it's a bit weedy, but it's there. So you've got a tiny glimpse of the geography. Now, what Chris McQuarrie does is he uses common geography between characters to set up where everybody is in the room before you cut to the wide shot. So we have these great close-ups on Cary Elwes, where he stood looking out of his window, but we're on his face and we see the characters behind him out of focus. And the camera is hinging around this close-up on Cary. So you're feeling his thoughts as the characters are speaking behind him, but you get a sense of the room. All the coverage, some of it is clean singles, some of it's 135mm, where you're really close on a character. You know, what we're doing is we're choosing to cut to characters for very clear pieces of information that the audience has to get. You know, understanding that the entity is destroying truth as we know it, and anything that's digital is corrupted. And, you know, we cut to 135mm close-up of someone talking almost directly at the camera so that you're forced to listen to it. And then other times we're profile on a character talking and we'll see another character behind. So you'll go, oh, that character's sitting over there behind this character. And then you will go to this character and you'll see them also sitting behind this character. So there's quite a lot of profile shots where in the nightclub we're profile on the widow and you see Ilsa sat behind her. And then we're also profile on Gabriel and you see Ilsa sat behind her. So you understand that there's common geography. So we're relying on the audience to put the geography of the scene together a little bit in their head, or not even do it, but subconsciously do it so that they're not confused. But that means that we can use very strong, close angles on the characters to keep you emotionally engaged. And interestingly, in these dialogue scenes, McHugh always overwrites them so that he can modulate the amount of exposition in each scene, because Mission Impossible is all about exposition in exactly the right amount when you need it, you know, when you're hungry for it. And if there's too much, you can trim it down. You can take stuff out. And actually, we did trim out quite a bit of the DNI. And again, some of it we were still getting questions about. So we ended up putting in three or four lines of dialogue, like literally a week before we locked the edit, because people were still had a slight question about something. And we're so sensitive that McHugh is very sensitive to that. But he is relying on you to tune out of the scene, because as human beings, that is what our minds do. So if I'm talking to you, Steve, and I mention that, you know, yesterday morning, it was my mum's birthday, your mind may drift off to think about your mum, right? And it'll take you like a few beats to kind of rejoin the conversation with me. Now, McHugh is expecting that to happen in these big dialogue scenes. So what we do is we deliberately choose to cut to certain close-ups and certain dynamic strong angles to kind of jolt you out of your thoughts and allow you to refocus on the scene. And we're always cutting when there's a very important word or an important piece of information. But the rhythms of these scenes are built so that McHugh wants you to kind of drift around it. But when he wants you to pay attention, you will be. When there's an important piece of information, you will be. Now, if you want to listen to every line of dialogue, it is all crafted very carefully and it will feed in and it will enrich your experience of the film. But if you tune out for a few beats every so often, it won't matter, because he knows that he's got you paying attention when you really need to hear the important stuff. So that is how we've ended up with a lot of close-ups in these scenes. Just pay attention to the common geography. The Department of National Intelligence is like a 12-minute scene. I mean, it's an enormously long scene to have near the beginning of a movie. But there's a lot of intrigue in it. And there's this mystery character who comes in who is going to cause trouble. And so there's suspense as well. And it's one of those scenes which Chris McQuarrie does brilliantly, where it feels exciting and suspenseful as you're watching it because of the stakes and because everyone in the room is powerful and maybe dangerous. And I mean, he's just a genius at writing and shooting those. And they don't cut together ever very easily at all. We revise the edit endlessly. We'll go back to it 50 or 60 times in the process of cutting the film, you know, almost daily at some points. He'll be like, right, let's just take 10 minutes, 12 minutes, watch the scene. okay, now I'm feeling this, now I'm feeling that, this can be better, this can be better, this can be better. And we will just refine and refine and refine and refine, and then screen and screen and screen, and then refine and refine. You know, nothing, not a, there's not a single easy sequence in this whole film, you know, apart from maybe Ethan getting the mission briefing, because it's one guy and some photographs on a table. But all the other sequences are multiple characters, parallel storytelling. Editorially, we're keeping lots of different characters alive, lots of plates spinning, and there's lots of things at stake, and the audience has to keep track of who is where and what's happening. And Benji's here in the airport, and Luther is here, and Ethan is here, and Grace is here, you know. And then in Rome, in the car chase, it's like, where is Briggs and Dagar, you know, the cops? Where's Paris in the Hummer? You know, where, how are we intercutting all of this? And then the same in Venice, lots of long dialogue scenes, then this massive chase where we're intercutting between different people, intercutting a big fight scene. Then on the train, it's just this gigantic puzzle of, you know, we're with Grace, then we're with the widow, then we're with Paris, and then we're with Ethan, Benji. And again, everything starts out long and a bit of a mess. And then we slowly kind of refine it and discover what the audience actually needs beat for beat through the sequence. And when they're telling us it's too long, originally the scene between the widow and Kittredge was much longer and had great stuff in it, very humorous stuff, great stuff, but ended up being collapsed down and collapsed down so that it's just the right amount for you to understand the story that she's, you know, getting the money and choosing to sell the key and all that stuff. So yeah, that, there you go. That's the answer to the question of the coverage and the dialogue scenes.
One of the edits that I loved, and I right now I can't even remember what it was other than my note, I noticed a fun edit from the shovel smack to the champagne bubbling.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's, again, great directing from Chris McCrory. Gabriel smacks the driver of the train with the shovel, and then we cut to the champagne glass kind of bubbling in the foreground because the train is now going fast. It's a runaway train, so the whole carriage is shaking, and then Paris just walks past very nonchalantly in the background as she's making her way down to the back of the train. But that is beautiful directing from Chris McCrory. I can't take any credit for that. That was totally his idea. It was effortless. All I had to do was make the cut and then trim it by a few frames to make it the right length. And then it was done, you know. But yeah, that's terrific fun.
Going back to the mission briefing, you mentioned how easy it was, but I was thinking how challenging it was because you're trying to keep exposition visually interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Listen, it's easy in comparison to the other scenes in the film, which are all really difficult. I mean, like monumentally complicated scenes. You know, any editor watching this will feel the complexity and be very glad that they haven't had to do it, quite frankly. You know, when I watched Avengers Endgame, for example, and Jeff Ford was juggling all those storylines and characters and heroic moments and time travel and all that, I was just like, my God, this is a masterpiece. And I cannot believe a film like that did not get nominated for anything. But then neither did any of the Harry Potter films. And, you know, it's a great shame. I really feel like Avengers Endgame should have won everything. Like Lord of the Rings, Return of the King won everything. Just to say thank you to the enormous amount of goodwill those filmmakers and the Marvel Studios team created for the industry as a whole. It's you know, a mind-blowing achievement. The real trick is to be able to watch the film with no sound at all, because it's purely a visual medium, obviously, and most of the audience will not speak English. You know, over half the people watching this movie, in theory, won't have English as a first language. And we always do a pass where we watched each scene with the sound off to make sure that the rhythms feel right and that the story visually is clear without any dialogue scenes and action scenes. And the mission briefing is no exception. So you're seeing the choice of shots. You know, we're cutting close to the key, for example, when he lifts, to make sure that that is given a very strong presence in the story. You know, it's almost the whole width of the cinema screen, because this is the MacGuffin and we want everyone to pay attention. We're using the transitions as Ethan is going through the photos as cut points, you know, and then he's putting photographs down of the bounty hunters and of Ilsa, and we're bouncing off Ethan's reaction. So when we first see Ilsa, it's actually off a reaction of Ethan doing a small double take, because he's like, wait, I wasn't expecting Ilsa to be in this mission briefing. He's always tried to be subjectively in Ethan's point of view. But then we're choosing to cut on certain words of the mission briefing. Find the bounty hunters and you cut to the and you may just find her, and we cut to Ilsa. We're trying to punctuate everything with close-ups to indicate. So it's very easy to watch
and you're not having to do any work. That's the holy grail, literally, for Chris McQuarrie, is for the audience to not have to work to engage in the movie. Like, we have to do the work for you. We have to rub your nose in it so that your eye is guided around the frame effortlessly, so you don't have to find details. It's like, this is what we want you to look at right now, because this is what's important for the story. The same goes for all the graphics in the airport. Every time we're showing something on Benji's screen, we're rotating the graphics and bringing stuff into the foreground, giving you orientation of the airport where Benji's underneath, Ethan's on top, you know, this is where the bag is, all that stuff. And those graphics look easy, but believe me, there's 50 or 60 iterations to get to that point where it's effortless for the audience. And I'm talking about a kid to watch it as well. Human beings, you know, we're meaning-making machines, and we're always trying to attribute meaning and emotion to what we see, especially in a narrative. When we're watching a shot, we're instantly trying to get emotion out of it. And McHugh just wants to give you that emotion and serve it up so that you can just watch the movie and get lost in it and feel it. Again, it's not about information. It's all just about emotion as much as it can be through the movie. And the same was for Top Gun. And a lot of the lessons he learned from Top Gun, he kind of rolled into this film, I think, in terms of what he wrote and as a producer on that movie. And again, how the audience reacted to the film. And astonishingly, as I speak to you, we are at 99% on Rotten Tomatoes, which is even higher than Top Gun was, which is, I never believed we would be in this position. But that is all a tribute to Chris McQuarrie and Tom Cruise refining this process of giving the audience an emotional experience. And very fortunately, the audiences are responding very positively to that, which is, as somebody who has dreamed of doing this their whole life, is so rewarding and exciting for us. And knowing also that a lot of people come out of this film going, I would sit down and watch part two right now, you know, which is great.
Or watch part one again. Yes,
yeah. And we will. Like, I know that there will be screenings when part two comes out where you'll be able to do a double bill and watch them both. Because the first one will be a lot more satisfying when you see the second one. And we're setting up a lot of stuff which will pay off very elegantly in the next movie. But the end of this movie still feels satisfying. And that was something that Tom and McHugh were really striving for. And I will be fair to them, they cracked it at the very beginning. Like, we never had a problem with people going, it doesn't feel satisfying at the end of the film. You know, Chris wrote and conceived of this idea of this beat between Grace and Kittredge at the end of the film, which I won't spoil. But when you get to that point, it's very satisfying because you've seen a character transform from a selfish individual to somebody who is putting other people's safety before her own. She is choosing to join the team. And, you know, what's great is that you're seeing Ethan's origin story and Luther's origin story and Benji's origin story through Grace. Like, they all had backgrounds like Grace, and they were all at some point offered the choice. And you will see more of that in the next film, which will be very satisfying for people. McHugh's genius, quite frankly, of how he managed to fold all that in so that you're learning about the origin story of these other characters by seeing the character of Grace transform so much in the process of this story.
You mentioned that the scene with the mask machine failing was a reshoot.
Yes.
I wanted to talk a little bit about that because that's a classic IMF moment where you are hearing them discuss the plan. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to put you in this mask. I'm not going to say who, but we're going to put you in this mask and you're going to go off and do this. And you're intercutting that with what actually happens.
Yes.
Was it scripted that way or was that a process of trying to condense the movie?
Well, what's quite fun is the fact that Ethan says to Grace, come with us and be a ghost. Then we cut to the scene, this great one where we see a mask being applied, which is very, very elegant. It has two stitches in it. If you're a filmmaker, you'll see the stitches easily.
I wanted to ask you, is that a Texas switch?
It is a Texas switch, yes. Yeah, it's just a very elegant Texas switch when we come up behind Benji and he's doing the hair and stuff. As usual with Mission, they had a whole different idea, which didn't work. And so they had to come up with that on the day. So they spent like 3 or 4 hours in the morning spitballing different ways of doing it. And then eventually McHugh said, I know, a Texas switch, which is so satisfying. And it's so like 1930s, you know, it's just very elegant, old school, fun filmmaking.
Can you explain for people who don't know what a Texas switch is, what a Texas switch is?
So effectively, it's where one character will be switched out
for a different actor wearing the same clothes. That's an example. Someone will run off screen to the left and then they'll reappear behind the camera on the right. Magicians do it all the time. Anytime you watch a magician doing an escape trick where they're tied up and then a curtain comes down and then the curtain comes up and they've disappeared or whatever, then they run out and they've changed their clothes and they're in the audience or something. It's kind of like a visual Texas switch. But for a film, we did it actually in Fallout when Henry Cavill pulls Tom Cruise's air hose out before he does the Halo jump. You see Henry pull Ethan's hose and then you're with Ethan and you see Henry run out and jump out of the plane. But he actually, the camera is off him for a tiny beat. And then the professional skydiver dressed as Henry Cavill runs out instead. But so the Texas switch in this case is we have Hayley Atwell having a blonde wig put on. And then as we come up behind Benji, we kind of go around her back and we hide the transition in the blonde hair. And then Vanessa Kirby steps forward in the same clothes. But because we're behind on the blonde hair, you don't realize until she walks over to the mirror. And then you're like, oh my God, how did that happen? And any filmmaker listening will, when they see the film, they'll see it. But it's great fun. We always call them what ifs. It's like, this is what's supposed to happen. This is the what if scene. And we've got a great music cue from Lorne and Cecile, our music editor, and we see what's supposed to happen. And then there's a great transition where you see Ethan like launch off the train with a parachute. And then you cut back into the same scene and you realize that it was all because the audience is thinking that they're going on the mission. And then Grace interrupts and you're pulled back into the moment. And it's quite amusing because you realize that she just thinks this is a terrible idea, you know, and she's never heard anything so preposterous. But that was always scripted and designed like that.
So with compression, and you were talking about things that were fantastic, they're great the way they are, they're long. One of those scenes that I was interested in hearing about was the Venice intercutting between what's going on the bridge, a sword fight on the bridge, and Tom trying to get to that sword fight. He was realizing that that's going to happen. Talk to me about, one, the intercutting, and two, just deciding, like, that scene could be 20 minutes long or it could be 2 minutes long, and you have got to decide that.
Yeah, it was much, 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 much longer, as these things always are. Any editor watching will realize that there's a million ways to cut this, to cut away from the fight. You know, when do you cut to Ethan? How often do you cut to Ethan? When do you cut to Ethan in the alleyway with Grace? Do you finish the fight with Ethan in the alleyway and have him running longer? You know, there's so many options. The one sequence that got compressed the most was Gabriel fighting Grace, you know, the knife fight with Grace. That was one where we really did take it down to the bones. I would say it's a quarter of what we had originally, something like that, because you are more interested in Ethan fighting Paris, which we only trimmed a very short section of that in an arrow alleyway fight. And then one of the challenges was making the sword fight between Ilsa and Gabriel long enough so that it was satisfying, but not short enough that it was inconsequential. A lot of that had to do with the music cue. We initially had a music cue that was like a driving cue, but it didn't feel like it was slowly building to a climax, or that you felt like this is not going to end well. And the music cue that's there now, if you listen to it, it is building to inevitable conclusion, but it's not like a heroic conclusion. It's like tragic conclusion.
But you don't want the music to give it away.
No, but you do want the music to be telling you this is building to something, right? Rather than she's on top. We had a music cue which felt like she was on top, and she is on top for a lot of the fight, and then she isn't for a small section. There's also one of the notes we got from people was Ethan feels like he's running forever, you know, which was in an earlier iteration. I don't know. We went back to that endless times, at least 30 different ways of intercutting everything. I would say maybe more. And again, only settled on it right at the end when the music cue was starting to kind of work properly for us. And getting the music cue right was instrumental in that feeling satisfying and emotional in the way that we wanted the audience to feel. You know, when Ethan is running up at the end, you know, when he runs into the white light and he's this silhouette coming out of this kind of angelic white light. And it was very rewarding when we finally got that working. And we got that to work, I think, for the third preview. It was pretty good, you know, and people were not giving us notes about it being too long, that we had cracked that. But the one thing we didn't crack was people having a firm grasp of the entity as a character. It's very hard to anthropomorphize a piece of computer code. Our production designer, Gary, found this incredible artist, and he had come up with this piece of art, which Gary had seen in an art gallery, which is what you see on the wall of the nightclub representing the entity. It's this circular eye thing with all this stuff kind of moving around it. In our last Friends and Family screening, Edgar Wright said, there should be some sound or music associated with the entity. And we thought, as filmmakers, we had a entity leitmotif in the music, but we had used it too broadly. And so we'd used it more as Gabriel and the entity. People weren't connecting it with just the AI. And my instinct was we should have a sound when we're on the close-ups of the entity in the nightclub. I was imagining something like a very subsonic, earth-shaking, low-frequency kind of rumble when we're on the close-ups, but not anything else. I just felt you wanted to feel like intense power coming off this thing. But then we went a lot deeper and we said to James Mather, the supervising sound designer, we said, look, we need a sound with something digital, but scary and unusual and unquantifiable. And he said, you know something, I listen to this. And he got his phone out and he scrolled through some voice memos and he played this sound. We were like, that's amazing. It was that this like this digital clicky sound. And he said, so 3 years ago, my Sonos soundbar malfunctioned. And this is the sound it made when some HDMI connection was futzed slightly. And it was a digital distortion coming through this soundbar. And he recorded it. And then he was like, wait, this is cool. And if I reboot it, it's never going to do this again. So he got a proper microphone, as any good sound designer will do. He went and recorded it properly on a microphone. Because he couldn't tap into it. There wasn't a way of like feeding the HDMI signal out. He had to literally record it from the speakers from the Sonos soundbar. And he recorded it for like 5 minutes. And I even think he like put on a bit of Fallout and played some of Fallout through it and recorded it. So that's what you're hearing, is this version of Fallout played distorted through his soundbar. Anyways, we had like 5 minutes of it and we were able to cherry pick the best bits of it and cut it up and put it in the, and then we were like, wait, we could put it when Ethan stands up in the nightclub and like looks around, and we could put it earlier in the nightclub. How about we put it when it's on the submarine? Yeah, we could use it there, and we could use it when it's pretending to be Benji. When we're with Luther and Benji and it's the fake AI Benji voice, it could be present there. And now suddenly this whole load of ideas exploded and we went through the movie. We were like, we use it here. It was all because Edgar Wright said there should be some sonic sound design treatment to help anthropomorphize this computer code so it has some sense of power and you can treat it immersively in the nightclub and stuff. And that is how we ended up with what you hear in the film now, which I swear made all the difference to the audience perceiving this AI. And of course, we can evolve that into the next film a lot more, because the entity as an antagonist will be much more powerful in the next film while Ethan is trying to figure out how to save the world.
And that was all discovered in the last week of the mix.
Yeah, that was in the last week of the mix. And thank heavens for James Mather and his team. When we came up with this sound and put it on, then basically all the notes on the film went away and it just became subjective notes, which are your taste or my taste. It wasn't just confusion or boredom or pace issues. And so we knew we'd fixed all the problems at that point. But as you know, as any filmmaker or any editor is listening, you're constantly stress testing the movie and confronting it to go, can this be clearer? Can this be better? Are the audience still asking us any questions or giving us any notes about this? And you don't give up. I mean, you use the time that you have, but you really, towards the end, when you're really out of time, you're racking your brain constantly trying to think, can I fix this? Can I improve this?
You use some dissolves coming out of emotional moments that I liked. That's when I noticed the dissolves happening. Something emotional, powerful happens. You give the audience a chance to breathe.
Yeah, that is true. And we feel those. And the music's also helping at that point. You know, the music gives you a chance to breathe. The other great thing about dissolves is they can hold your hand as a transition into the next scene
without you feeling another scene starting. So for example, at the end of the desert, we crossfade into the TV screen, into the DNI, and you feel like those two scenes are kind of organically linked somehow, which they are, because we've come off the key and we've seen Ilsa and we're going into the DNI. But it's interesting because it's a dissolve. In your mind, you're not mentally resetting into a new environment. You know, and we originally had it, actually, the desert scene used to play as one whole chunk. And you'll know, having seen the film, that we end on a semi cliffhanger and then we go into the DNI and then we see what happened later in the scene, which again helped you feel less chaptery in the story. It felt like it was more continuous. And again, discovered that in the last week as well. You know, because this podcast is about editorial storytelling, this is perfect because editors will geek out about this, but a lot of people, it won't really add up. They won't be able to understand the power of that in the audience's mind in terms of pacing out the story and keeping the audience in a bit of suspense there. Initially, we used to pay that off at the end of Rome. So imagine if you had discovered what happens in the desert and then you go all the way to Rome. And you know, when Ilsa turns up in the van at the end of Rome, then the audience would be like, wait, what? She's there. Then we showed what happened in the desert. And that was what the original thing was written as. But it was way too late because the audience was thinking about where Ilsa ended up in the desert. They were just kept in suspense for like an hour, which was ridiculously way too long. Even though we took a swing at it and we tried it, it just didn't work. We ended up moving that into the middle of the scene between Ethan and Kittredge in the DNI. The other thing, which if you happen to see the film again, is we use two frame dissolves for flashbacks. Sometimes one frame dissolves. It's a very, very subtle subconscious effect. But for example, when Ethan is having the mission briefing at the beginning, when he's going back into his memories of Marie and Gabriel, it's a two frame dissolve. So it just softens the cut. It's not a hard cut. It's like a soft cut. Again, it's a subconscious effect, but it's something that McHugh was like, let's just try this. And I've never done it before. It never occurred to me, but it was Chris's idea. And we would choose two frame or one frame. And then, for example, when he's talking about Gabriel, when he's in the Venice safe house and he's saying, somebody I thought died a long time ago, we use these little two frame dissolves there as well. And even in the nightclub, when we're cutting from Ethan to the entity, we have these soft dissolves there, two frame dissolves, soft cuts there. And if you want to be super nerdy, if you step through those moments, we've aligned Ethan's eye and Gabriel's eye so that their eyes are kind of aligned over the dissolve, and really nerdy shit like that, which is just for the real film fans who want to study the edit of the movie. But again, no detail is too insignificant. You know, McHugh's always like, oh, let's try this, let's try this, let's get this working. And it all adds up. When you watch the film, you can feel how much love and care has been poured into it, because hopefully, well, filmmakers will feel like this one complex sequence after another, but the audience will just go, this is a lot of cool shit, and I'm following it all, and I love it, and I'm getting my money's worth, and it's a great kind of movie. You know, it's just an ambitious, big-scale, epic story. I didn't have any problem following it. I was excited. I was leaning in. The music was cool. But filmmakers will go, whoa, that was a lot of work, and they can feel the work that's been put into it. Honestly, if we'd tried to cut this movie in a year, it would not have been as good. We needed the whole 2.5 years to do it, to find that and work with the material, you know, and really discover what the movie wanted to be.
I want to point out to the audience two things that you said that I wanted them to think about some more. One is, you were talking about intercutting the knife fight and Ethan in the alley and how you kept Ethan's longer and the knife fight shorter. And that pays off later, because what happens in the alley emotionally is more important at the end of the film.
Yes, you're absolutely right.
So you can't shortchange. You can't go, oh, the whole thing's too long, let's shorten the alley, let's shorten the knife fight. You got to go, no, the alley's too important to shorten that.
Absolutely right. Yeah, yeah.
Eddie, I've taken way too much of your time, and I'm sure the Art of the Cut audience is excited to have that much time with you explaining these great things about the movie. What a great ride. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you so much. I listen every week. I love the show. It's always a pleasure to be on. Hello, everyone out there in podcast land, watching or listening to this in the gym or walking the dog or
driving through LA.
Driving through LA. When I'm watching hours and hours of dailies, and it's action dailies, so there's no sound. I'm always listening to your podcast and listening to other editors and trying to learn about other ways people do stuff. And I really love what you do. And I can't wait to read the new book and all of the above. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you so much.
That's it for Art of the Cut this week. Thank you so much for listening. Again, if you'd prefer to read this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to borisfx.com/AOTC, where there's a ton of great expert content for filmmakers of all types. Also, check out my book, Art of the Cut, Conversations with Film and TV Editors, for a topic-driven curated look at the craft of editing. Thanks to Eddie Hamilton, ACE, for joining me on Art of the Cut. And thanks to a new member of the team, Heidi Choi, for editing today's podcast. And thanks to our partner, Boris Effects, and to our sponsors, Jump Desktop and Lens Distortions. Be sure to check them out at borisfx.com, jumpdesktop.com/cut, and lensdistortions.com/AOTC. I'm Steve Hallfish. Thanks for listening. Please tell all the editors and filmmakers that you know that to get more great Art of the Cut interviews every week, please subscribe on your favorite podcast app. And for a great feed of editing wisdom from Art of the Cut, follow me on Twitter at Steve Hallfish or Insta at AOTC Podcast. We also have a YouTube channel, which you can find by searching for at Art of the Cut.